Mr. Phillips?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'd like to start with the objective baseless issue in this particular case, because it seems to me the District Court has done a very thorough job of analyzing every element of this case. The District Judge obviously presided over the entirety of this litigation, analyzed the case for purposes of summary judgment, and then reanalyzed the case for purposes of analyzing the merits of the claim and whether or not this would be an exceptional case. To be sure, it applied the Brooks standard, but basically what it analyzed was just simply whether there was an objectively legitimate basis for the decision. It's not that it has zero merit. Counsel keeps saying zero merit is objectively baseless. That's not the standard. This Court held in PRE that objectively baseless means that there has to be probable cause, that it lacks probable cause to go forward, that it has to be reasonably possible.
Well, in PRE, of course, we were concerned about infringing on First Amendment rights, and that's not the case here.
Well, I think you could argue that there is at least a First Amendment concern that's in here, but in any event, what it seems
to
me you really —
First Amendment concern what?
Well, access to the courts. Access to the courts. There's any time you talk about imposing multimillion-dollar fee awards at the end of the litigation, particularly if you do it on a fairly arbitrary basis.
You think Congress could not require the loser to pay?
Oh, I have no doubt.
In all cases?
Well, I'm not sure about it all cases.
I mean, if it can do that, there's surely no First Amendment problem.
Well, I'm not sure I'd concede that in all cases. I do think in the run-of-the-mill cases, but when you're talking about a situation where the assertion is that the conduct of the litigation, the bringing of the litigation itself —
the English rule. It used to be our rule. I don't see how you can possibly say that it's unconstitutional to make the loser pay.
This is not your best argument, is it?
It is not my best argument. I appreciate that, Justice Kennedy. On the other hand, if you go back and look at Christiansburg, in that case, the Court also didn't treat it as a First Amendment issue, but it still recognized it's an important policy of trying not to have too much interference with access to the courts. In any event, objectively baseless is a standard that every court knows how to use, and it goes directly to the ultimate.
From sanctionable misconduct, seems to me that under the way you're articulating things, the conduct has to be sanctionable before you can give attorneys fees under this provision. So why bother having the provision?
Well, because the provision was enacted in 1952, Justice Sotomayor, long before this kind of litigation, these kind of rules that would have rendered the litigation sanctionable existed. And so as a consequence of that, and I think it's important to put it in context, because, you know, when Congress did this initially in 1946, to be sure, it's the Senate report that talks about gross injustice, but it is the decisions of the courts that adopted that approach of gross injustice. And then when Congress in 1952 incorporates the exceptional case standard, the revisor's notes say it's designed to go back to the legislative history and the decisions that have been interpreted.
Why does it always have to be objectively baseless? I mean, I've read enough cases in this area to be able to approach it as a district court judge who's not expert. I patent the following. For a computer, enter somebody's name, ask phone number, and they'll give you the phone number if you put in the right city. That puts some lists in the computer. They can patent that? Well, you add a couple of things, and they apparently, you're going to have an argument that they can patent it, okay? Because it'll be very abstract language. It'll be able to patent almost anything. No, you can't finally, but objectively baseless. The patent attorneys are very brilliant at figuring out just how to do this. So we're never going to have attorney's fees in a suit if that's your standard.
Well,
but you could couple that with just barely over the line. What line? This vague line, no one knows what it is. In addition, all they did was say, we don't want to go to court and cost you $2 million. Please send us a check for $1,000. We'll license it for you. They do that to 40,000 people, and when somebody challenges it and goes to court, it costs them about $2 million because every discovery in sight. Okay? You see where I'm going?
Yes.
And so I do not see why you couldn't have an exceptional case where attorney's fees should be shifted. But if I'm honest about it, I cannot say it's objectively baseless. I can just say it's pretty close to whatever that line is, which I can't describe, and look at all this other stuff. Are you going to say that I can't shift?
I think the problem with the approach you propose there, Justice Breyer, is you're trying to deal with a very small slice of the problem of litigation, you know, what you've described.
No, but of course, it may be a small slice of litigation, but it is a slice that costs a lot of people a lot of money.
But the problem,
and so I would like to know, if I do run across that small slice, why cannot I, the district judge, say, I've seen all these things? Taken together, they spell serious injustice, and therefore I'm shifting the fees. Okay? Why can I not do that, even though, as I just said and repeat, I cannot in honesty say
because
it's frivolous given the standards for patenting that seem to be administered?
Because when Congress enacted the statute, adopted the exceptional case standard, it meant essentially to require that the litigation be unjustified and vexatious. Unjustified means that it is baseless. That's the understanding that existed all along. It has to have — it's not that it has zero merit, but it has to have enough merit to be to satisfy the standards of probable cause.
Well, it's baseless is at the end of the day. I mean, you have a case that involves a straight stroke rail that at one end goes in an elliptical arc, and the district judge has to figure this out with all the experts. After he goes through all the underbrush, he finds there's nothing there. And it's hard to say that that's objectively baseless to a district judge who's spent weeks studying this thing. But at the end of the day, suppose he finds there's nothing there.
Well, if at the end of the day there's nothing there, then I think it is objectively baseless, even though they've gone through the litigation. But what the district judge
did — nothing there. It's highly abstract language. I gather you, like I, have read some of these claims. They're very hard to understand. And when you get to the bottom of it, the abstract nature of the language, plus the fact that it has something to do with computer input, plus the fact that, you know, you suspect very strongly it's baseless, but you really don't like to say something that isn't true, and you can say, well, I could see how somebody might think there was something to this claim just in that tone of voice, which you can't write down that tone of voice. You see?
It usually comes through in the opinions, actually.
Yeah, I see. You see the problem.
No, but,
I don't see why. It
but, Justice Breyer, the case you have in front of you, though, is not a case like that.
Oh, well, let's send it back and tell them that they were imposing a standard that was too narrow, that was didn't take count of all the circumstances where something could be unusually unjust, and then let them apply. No clear and convincing.
Right.
But it's up to you, district judge. You're the expert on litigation. You decide when something.
Can I say two things about that? First of all, the clear and convincing evidence issue is not in the case. They didn't seek certiorari on that issue. You know, if the court wants to.
If the court is dealing with the Federal Circuit's test and it's got these two things, baseless and subjectively, and clear and convincing evidence, I think to leave out that piece of it when it all comes out of that one paragraph in the Brooks Furniture case. So I think once the case is before us, if we leave out that one piece.
I don't, Justice Ginsburg, I do not believe that the clear and convincing evidence standard is fairly subsumed within the question of whether or not the objective baselessness standard ought to be applied any more than the second case you're going to hear today is subsumed by this case. They all come out of the Federal Circuit, but it seems to me you ought to grant separately on the question of the standard of review or the standard of proof at the appropriate time.
Why don't we just take is another statute, as you know, has identical wording, the Lanham Act, and that says exceptional means not run of the mind, uncommon. And then there's a nice illustration, a case from the D.C. Circuit.
I read that opinion.
Why don't we say, well, we have it there in the Lanham Act, same words.
Right, but there are a couple reasons for that. One is, obviously, this statute was passed long before the Lanham Act was enacted and against a very different backdrop. And Congress clearly, in literally sticking its toe in the water of allowing prevailing defendants to get fees from plaintiffs in a situation that is pretty unprecedented at that point in time, set the standard very high and intended for it to prevent gross injustice. The legislative history of the Lanham Act, which this Court apparently was willing to read for those purposes at that time, doesn't remotely suggest that. And the Court didn't take into account, in that opinion, the standards under the Patent Act in interpreting the Lanham Act. So it seems to me you could make the argument the opposite way, which is that the Lanham Act ought to be interpreted the way I propose.
And the text is identical in both. In the legislative history, some people like it, some people don't. But the text is identical. So I think it would be odd to construe the very same words in the context of the Lanham Act one way and a different way in the context of the Patent Act.
Well, two answers to that. One is, if you want to interpret them in tandem, I would say you should interpret the Patent Act in the strict way that Congress intended it to be interpreted in 1952, and the Lanham Act should follow that. The alternative is there is a different history. Patent litigation and trademark litigation are very, very different in the impact that they have. And as a consequence of that, it seems to me you could, in fact, say that Congress didn't intend that. But that seems to me in some ways the tail wagging the dog, and that's a mistake. One thing I do want to say, Justice Breyer, in response to your argument about why don't you leave it for the district court in that circumstance. The problem is what you're saying to plaintiffs who bring patent litigation with in this case, counsel's advice and expert's advice. They got the machines. They did everything you'd want a litigant to do before bringing a litigation. They handled the case. They spend more money on legal fees as the plaintiff than the defendants did in this case. They have to hire an expert. They put in play the validity of their patent. There are lots of disincentives for plaintiffs to bring in this case. And at the end of the process, based on a completely indeterminate standard, the district court would then retain authority to say, I conclude that what you did here is unreasonable.
That's true, but you could then appeal. I mean, you're making an argument on the merits there, and really the question is who's better suited to figure out whether this is a really special case? And if, you know, of course you're right. Plaintiffs are often right in these things, and sometimes they're wrong. So they cost everybody a lot of money. So you go to the Federal Circuit and ask them to review it for an abuse of discretion.
Mr. Phillips, their lawyers might well have given them different advice if they didn't know that, nothing to lose given the test that the Federal Circuit has, you know?
Well, I mean, the idea that there's nothing to lose.
I would give the same advice. Bring the suit.
Justice Scalia. You know,
this guy's a possible competitor. Sue him. There's nothing to lose.
But there is something to lose. First of all, as I say, the plaintiff, there's a reason why you don't see advertisements on television when Science and Kirk says, if you think your patent's been infringed, call us. Why? Because there's not a long line of people who can bring plaintiffs' patent cases. They are expensive to litigate, and the ultimate effect, and you have to get an expert, and at the end, you put your patent
in validity. If it goes to litigation, yes, but if the alternative for the defendant is either, you know, spend $2 million defending or pay off the $10,000 that the plaintiff demands to go away, hey, that's an easy call.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether that's an easy call for the defendant. It doesn't make the decision for the plaintiff all that easy at the beginning of the process because, as I say, it's both expensive and it puts the validity of the patent at issue and — in most cases, you know, the Federal Circuit long time ago, or not that long ago, said that the inequitable conduct, that is, challenging what the plaintiff did before the PTO, had become a plague of patent litigation. So plaintiffs who walk into court under those circumstances are not doing it without
this. The difficulty here, I'm seeing it from my point of view for a second. Of course, I think that there's no plaintiff-defendant necessary difference of who can act badly.
Of course.
All right. And so the question is really, who is likely most to know? And I think probably the district court. But then if you give the power to the district court, there's a problem, of course, that you'll abuse it. So I say, well, then go to the Federal Circuit and say they have. You say, well, there's another way of approaching it, and that is have definite standards, which is what you want. And then the difficulty with definite standards is I can't think of a set of definite standards that doesn't do what you don't want to have happen, that it leans one way or the other. I mean, it looks as if, you see, the Federal Circuit's current standards leaned pretty much against the person who was sued. And it looks like and so the government comes up, well, we can't do better than this. It's a long list. And nobody's been able to think of some, so then I say, okay, Let's try the first approach, which is what we do with the Lanham Act. That's the whole long story. Right. What do you would like to say? I'd like to listen.
Right. And the answer to that is that the standards for inequitable conduct are reasonably well set. They get applied pretty routinely, and they create exceptional case determinations. Litigation misconduct, the standards are pretty well set, pretty well understood, and they give rise to exceptional case determinations and award of attorney's fees. This case is unusual in the sense that all it deals with is that bucket that talks about whether or not you had a substantial basis for putting before the court this litigation in the first instance.
Mr. Phillips, I realize that you have this argument that this statute was before Rule 11, so the superfluity argument doesn't work. But just as a matter of fact, would your standard give the court authority to order fees in any case in which it does not have authority by virtue of either Rule 11 or its inherent authority?
Are you asking me that just about the baseless litigation or all of 280? Because clearly inequitable conduct, willful infringement, and certain forms of litigation misconduct, which might create a basis for fees against the lawyer, might not actually operate against the party, where obviously 285 operates against the party. So there's a whole range of behavior that is controlled by 285 that has nothing to do with Rule 11, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, there's clearly some overlap between them, but that overlap shouldn't be shocking because, again, 285 was enacted in 1952 and Rule 11 didn't come into being a serious force until 1983.
But let me make sure I understand you. Give me an example of a case in which, under your standard, 285 could be used to order a payment of fees, but Rule 11 and inherent authority would not allow.
Again, I mean, the clear one. Again, if you're only talking about the baselessness component, I don't know that there is one like that. If you're talking about inequitable conduct, they would all be, because Rule 11 will never reach inequitable conduct involving the Patent and Trademark Office because it's completely irrelevant to that. So the statutes do have some overlap, but they don't have complete correspondence. To me, that's the
inequitable conduct to the Trademark Office, but not with respect to the suit itself.
Right, right.
So there is patent misconduct. There's nothing with respect to the suit itself that Rule 11 and inherent authority wouldn't get you anyway.
Well, litigation misconduct is something that may or may not go against the party, depending on which rule it is and how it plays out. So there — and the courts have long recognized that certain forms of vexatious behavior by litigants may lead you to a particular — to determine that something's an exceptional case. So there seem to me clearly there might be. What I am conceding is that I can't envision a situation where you have brought what a court has said is objectively baseless litigation in the first instance that might not have been actionable under Rule 11. The question would be at this stage you would go immediately against the party as opposed to potentially against the lawyer, and to that extent it obviously provides broader relief depending on which of the two parties might actually have.
What about the inherent authority? Justice Kagan brought this up, not just Rule 11, but inherent authority when the court finds that the litigation is baseless and brought in bad faith. It seems to me that your standard is the same as what the court could do without any statute.
I think that may be true. I don't think that was true in 1946 and then again in 1952. The whole notion of shifting fees to a losing plaintiff was all but unprecedented at the time. And the best evidence we have of the circumstances in which Congress wanted to have those fees imposed is to prevent a gross injustice. And it seems to me nothing better suits that test than something that is objectively baseless, as just that one bucket within which 285 operates. The other buckets obviously equally involve situations of gross injustice.
So where does the bad faith come in?
I'm sorry?
Where does the bad faith come in? Rule 11 doesn't include bad faith. It's just
I mean, we obviously have, because it's in the Federal Circuit's standard, we embrace it, but the reality is I don't need to win the bad faith argument. If this court concluded that bad faith it shouldn't be an independent factor, that would not bother me because the district judge already found that this is objectively not baseless, so that there ought to be a basis for affirmance on that ground alone. Alternatively, the court obviously could wait for another case in which to take up that issue. But we don't need to win that in order to prevail in this particular case, and it certainly wouldn't cause me any heartburn if the court were to jettison that part.
Would you address the clear and convincing?
I
know your argument that
that it's not before us. I mean, the rationale of clear and convincing, obviously, is whether you assume that the patent is being implemented in good faith, or being brought in good faith, and therefore creates sort of a presumption in favor of the of infringement and legitimacy, and then clear and convincing evidence is obviously designed to make it harder to get over that hurdle. Again, I'm not here to defend the clear and convincing evidence standard. I read the concurring opinion in the Federal Circuit as well, and you know, but it seems to me clearly not in this case. It's not subsumed by the question presented, and that's an issue that the court ought to wait for another day. Hopefully, I won't have to defend it at that time. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, I'd urge you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.